Finally, like many of you, I managed to get to the movies during my time off, and I forced myself to go and see Precious, the much-publicized film based on the novel Push. Push was written by a novelist who prefers to be known only as Sapphire. And it was one of those books that made a splash in certain circles when it first appeared, passed from hand to hand like one of those underground newspapers behind the Iron Curtain. I had read the book, so I knew what to expect. And what I expected was to be depressed. It's a very disturbing story about an obese black girl living in Harlem during the Reagan years who's pretty much used as a sex slave by her father and a punching bag by her mother. And the girl is illiterate. And she's pregnant. For the second time by, guess who, her slimy father. I told you it was depressing. Even though there is a redemption of sorts when Precious, with the help of a special teacher and friends, pushes herself to learn to read. Even the author wasn't sure her book should be made into a movie because, as she told my colleague Michelle Norris, she thought attaching visual imagery to such a dire story might be just too much. She says she changed her mind when she saw another film made by Lee Daniels, who directed the movie, but also she said Barack Obama's campaign success factored into her decision. She thought that images of black people living all kinds of ways and doing all kinds of things were now available to the world in a way that they had not been when she first wrote the book. Thus, she felt the story could be seen for what it was, the story of some girls, especially some black girls, but not of all black people. Can I just tell you, I'm no movie critic, but I think everything that has been said about the film is true. It is poverty porn, and it does invite you to gaze upon horror for a time so you can feel so much better about your own problems. It does allow you to see its sick family dynamic as a black problem when anybody who works with abused kids and women can tell you it most certainly is not. And yet, the film is riveting and powerful because it's true. We see this movie every day, at least I do, and it makes you say to yourself, now that I've seen it, what am I going to do about it? And it also made me think about the Obamas, oddly enough, especially Michelle Obama and those two famous and too much discussed biceps of hers, and her lovely clothes, and her regal but warm bearing. And I know that some people wonder why we care. Why we care what she wears and how she works out and when. There are those who will question why she needs a one-of-a-kind handmade gown for the administration's first state dinner, why indeed there needs to be such lavish entertaining at a time when so many people are out of work and out of their homes and scared about what the future will bring. And the answer, to me at least, is that that image was exactly what Sapphire was talking about. It's one image that the many preciouses of the world need. They need to see a woman like Michelle Obama who is strong and healthy and, if I may say, beautiful. They need to know that being healthy, fulfilled, and loved is not a fantasy in their heads, but a reality within reach. That being black need not be synonymous with dysfunction and sorrow. It's been surprising to me how many other people need to get that message, too. The amount of sick vitriol directed at the Obamas, even on well-respected political blogs, has shocked even me. And while I understand why the owners of these sites don't feel a need to police such venom, they might do well to think less about letting thoughtless racists rant and more about what the overlooked and unloved may need to get by. Someone to look up to, dare I say it, someone to make them feel they are indeed precious. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
I'm Melissa Block, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. As the temperature drops and all you lovers out there find yourselves snuggling on the couch or trying to lure a crush to the nearest mistletoe, we thought we'd offer this lesson in mobile manners. Here's NPR's Art Silverman on how to hold your lover as close as your smartphone.
Ah, modern romance.
I was actually out with a guy who had his phone on. I couldn't see it, but I could hear it. And I literally was like, do you want me to check that for you? Are you not hearing that beep?
That veteran of dates interrupted by digital data is Beth Hughes, here to report from the front lines of the battle to keep a potential mate's attention in the moment. Hughes is 31, a resident of Arlington, Virginia. She's single and searching for a guy who knows when to use and when to ignore his mobile device.
I was fishing in my purse for a tissue or something, and I looked over and I could tell that he was under the table, like James Bond texting, you know, or BlackBerrying, and I was kind of like, do you really think that I don't see you over there? Kind of like trying to hide your paraphernalia from me. That's kind of rude. You do not want to see a guy's paraphernalia, at least on the first or second date.
And that's just one of the rules that Beth Hughes has in her personal code of conduct for dates. Some others are no heavy texting, no blinking BlackBerries at the bar, and no digital date making.
Midway through the date, first date, he pulls out his BlackBerry and he's like, so when can I get on your calendar? When are you available? How about next Wednesday? I have something here. It's almost like he was using the BlackBerry or the iPhone, whatever it was. It's almost like it was kind of showcasing his like tech savviness and the fact that he had a full calendar. And I was kind of like, it really was honestly a little bit of a turnoff.
Beth Hughes told the guy she'd get back to him. She didn't. Hughes is not alone in her desire to make the world safe from intrusion from mobile devices. But there are people who fall in love despite the barriers that handheld devices put up.
We met last year, right about the same time this iPhone came out.
Anushay Hussain fell for Shai Palavani just as he fell for his new mobile device. She lives in Arlington, Virginia, he in Washington, D.C. There's been an accepted menage a trois since then.
The iPhone has been this presence in our relationship.
At the beginning of our relationship.
But at the beginning of our relationship, he was on that iPhone like it was his job. I always used to joke, and I still say that his iPhone, Shai's iPhone, is the third person in our relationship.
And maybe there's a fourth. Anushay brings her own device to the relationship, a BlackBerry. They have everything worked out, sort of.
We'd be sitting on the couch and just watching TV, and I'll start talking to her, and she'll nod her head and as if she's listening to what I'm saying, and then I realize she's been on her BlackBerry the whole time.
I actually have picked up a lot of skills from him. He is a really big influence in my life as far as our mobile devices.
We're speaking to each other. You should put it away or acknowledge the fact that you're not just pretending to nod and you're into what the other person's trying to say.
You can do all this stuff and multitask. You know, women multitask all the time, so I'm genuinely listening to him and blogging. But I think the thing that irritates him is that, I mean, I'll even ask him to change the channel and I'll actually be, like, on my BlackBerry.
I think a BlackBerry is always cheating.
That's Brendan Greeley. Married, a father, he lives in Annapolis, Maryland. He's smart enough to recognize you can't split your loyalty.
You're either cheating on work, or you're cheating on your spouse, or you're cheating on home, or you're cheating on your kids. It's always cheating.
But Greeley avoids conflicts between his wife and his gadget. He does so by using a separate locale where his little keyboard won't be rude.
I told my wife, I just want you to know, I need you to know this first, but I'm going to tell America that I check my BlackBerry in the bathroom. It's true. You know, we're addicted to it. I think that's exactly why it's cheating. You know, you duck into the bathroom sometimes when you don't need to use it so that you can see what's happened. And I think that's exactly like having an affair. Not that I would know.
All this confusion over how to behave when a BlackBerry or iPhone intrudes on relationships may get worked out over time. One day, an open marriage between one man, one woman, and many handheld devices may be the norm. No doubt our children and grandchildren will be taught the etiquette for balancing all this. Until then... Oh, just a sec. Facebook update. Oh my gosh. Deborah needs a ravioli recipe. Where was I? Until then, we'll have to make those rules up as we go along. Gotta go. I have to answer this one. Art Silverman, NPR News.
If you have a story about your mobile device getting in the way of romance, we would love to hear it. Just go to the All Tech blog and find Art's recent post called Handholding versus Handheld. You can leave your story in the comments section. That's at npr.org/alltech.
Now, some small companies have gotten help from the federal stimulus package. A couple of provisions made it easier for companies to get loans through their banks. But now these programs are out of money. Kirk Sigler, member station KUNC, has more.
Say you're a small business wanting to expand, and your local bank is flinching at giving you a loan because lending restrictions are now tighter. But what if the government was willing to back up the risk of nearly all of your loan? Would banks be more willing to extend credit? Yes, and in fact, banks have, says Jonathan Swain.
These loans that we've been able to do under the Recovery Act have been a real lifeline.
Swain is a spokesman for the Small Business Administration. His agency has spent the last of $375 million meant to raise the maximum guarantee on SBA loans and help reduce some loan fees.
We've had a real impact, been able to get some much-needed capital out and in the hands of small businesses all across the country to help them keep their doors open, keep their employees working, and in some cases even create new jobs.
Banks making the loans have also praised the provisions, but Horace McCowan, vice president for KeyBank Colorado, says their expiration may not be the end of the world.
Hopefully this means the government is sensing that the economy is recovering, and these types of special stimuluses may not be necessary.
Still, the SBA is lobbying Congress for more money to keep the program going through February. For NPR News, I'm Kirk Sigler in Denver.
From big corporations, we turn now to small companies. Morning Edition has been talking to small business owners around the country to see how they're faring. Today, we meet Albert Ceja. Ceja's shop east of Los Angeles makes the machines that make tortillas. Like many small business owners, Ceja's has been hit by the downturn, but he can't get credit to keep his company going. Rob Schmitz of member station KQED has this report.
Al Ceja and his father owned Shipmasters, a shop that assembles tortilla-making machines. Last year at this time, they managed 55 full-time employees. Today, there are 9 left. They're trying to keep busy inside this lonely machine shop in a gritty corner of the San Gabriel Valley.
We're a high-profit, low-output operation here. People just stopped purchasing stuff, and that really, really hit us hard.
Ceja's tortilla machines cost a lot, up to $3 million. So far this year, he only made 1. Not too long ago, his crew made 17 a year. His orders dropped off last year when credit ground to a halt. His clients couldn't get loans, so he couldn't either. In what seemed like an instant, his cash flow was gone, and his employees were left with nothing to do. At first, Ceja asked them to paint the building, move around machinery, anything, to keep busy. But after a month or so, it was clear. He had to lay off guys who were as close to him as family. And for those who remained...
We told them, you know what, there's going to be days where the checks might come in a couple days late. Or if we give it to you on Friday, you might have to wait till Monday for it to clear. And these guys understood. They were the troopers. They're the guys that really stood in. The guys that really look out for the company.
Carlos Chavez is one of those guys. Chavez cuts sheet metal for a repair job. This represents a new business strategy for Chipmasters. Instead of making tortilla machines, the skeleton crew here is fixing them. Chavez agreed to cut back his hours so he could hold on to his job. With an unemployed wife and 3 children, he says he had no choice.
Many of my friends and family don't have any work at all. I've got a little work here, but at least I've got something. I'm lucky compared to most.
Hello?
Back in his office, Ceja says he's approached 8 different lenders to try and secure a line of credit. They all turned him down. His credit score, damaged from Chipmaster's lack of cash flow, was too low. He approached the Small Business Administration. Nothing there either. Behind his desk, a framed photo of a younger Ceja hangs on the wall. It's a portrait of him in a crisp military uniform.
I was a damn good Marine. I'm an American. I love being American, and I had a lot of faith in my country. And I thought, well, the government has to have prepared for this, you know, for something like this. And it was just, it was like a weird, deluded dream that I had.
Ceja wrote letters to the city, state, members of Congress, and even President Obama asking for help. Other than a form letter or two, hardly anyone responded. Not too long ago, Ceja contacted L.A. County for help. They sent someone who could help him secure a loan. He told her he still had faith in his country.
She laughed. She laughed. She laughed. And she works for the government. She laughed. She was sitting right there and she laughed. And I said, wow. Well, that's a reality check for me.
Ceja says when the economy does pick up, he's going to be ready. Lately, he's been reading books about Kaizen, the Japanese strategy for lean manufacturing. For NPR News, I'm Rob Schmidt in Los Angeles.